Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. This is a special longer edition, Epistemology Part 2. Before getting to reading some mostly article quotes from an essay that I wrote and in one of my books published in 2015, the essay was from 2014 and specifically gives background information to U.S. intervention in Ukraine with Israeli approval and what that's all about, because that exactly pertains to the background context of what is going on nowadays. But before getting to that, more specifically with the epistemology, I want to address some news and Twitter feeds. And this is as of Friday. Okay, so CNN headline, Russia condemned for, quote, reckless, unquote, nuclear power plant attack. Then somehow I managed to check RT, which is seemingly going to be going bankrupt or disbanding. But anyway, that RT headline, the Russian military says Kiev staged a, quote, horrible provocation, end quote. So there you have the two narratives in a nutshell there. Hence, epistemology. Another interesting article by Margaret Kimberly at Black Agenda Report. Ukraine exposes white supremacist foreign policy. That you'll hear more about as I read quotes from my essay. And then one of the highlights in her article is this, quote, instead of standing with Ukraine, Americans should stand with humanity across the world, end quote. So, and to that, I would say, with Mother Earth, stand with humanity and all beings and Mother Earth, because all this fighting is anti that. And here's Pepe Escobar, whose Twitters have become my main source now for knowing actually what's going on, because I trust him, a 37-year globe-trotting investigative journalist. China reportedly says here, Washington, as the root cause of the Ukraine tension, is in no position to ask other countries to condemn or sanction Russia. It cannot ask the whole world to pay for the chaos it has created. The U.S. and its close allies in NATO should bear the responsibility. Now, what he's referring to is the aforementioned, in part one, UN resolution, which actually goes back, there's a map, in 2016, the U.S. and Ukraine were the only nations that voted against a U.N. petition for combating the glorification of Nazism. And when you look at the map, you see clearly that, my geography's not good, but it seems like most or all of Europe is in the abstaining zone, and Canada is in the abstaining zone, and New Zealand, or is that Australia, is in the abstaining zone. And then Mexico, Latin America, Africa, Russia, China, Asian, Middle East are all in favor. And the only two countries against it are the aforementioned. So that clearly in the news now pertains to the this new Iron Curtain being promoted in the media, which is all Russia-phobia, anti-Russia bashing. So again, make up your own mind. Do your research. Here's Pepe again. Crash course. Never forget. Western Ukraine cheered Hitler's armies invading Russia, but not Eastern Ukraine. In World War II, Stalin took back Western Ukraine, previously under Poland, and gave Poland what had been East Prussia. Then he kicked the Germans out of Prussia. Ukro hatred of Russia stems from the Bandera Nazis, whose leader, Beletsky, is on a, quote, crusade against Semite-led Untermenschen, end quote. Untermenschen is the German World War II reference to subhuman. He recently, this is Bandera, the neo-Nazi, he recently ordered all Jews to leave Ukraine except Karaites, who only recognize the written Torah. No one knows anything about the Karaites. So there you see the tangle that is behind the pointing the finger at Putin. Another journalist who I follow, Aaron Mate, everything that is happening right now in Ukraine is exactly what Stephen F. Cohn tirelessly warned about. For speaking the truth, he was demonized and shunned, including from spaces that once relied on his expertise. Let his memory be an inspiration and a guide. Stephen Cohn, a famed scholar of Russian studies, warning in 2014 that, quote, if we move NATO forces toward Russia's borders, it's obviously going to militarize the situation and Russia will not back off. This is existential. End quote. He did say in an interview as well that Putin was the type that would compromise with negotiations, which that has been in the news. And once again, I feel it's significant to say that I'm not defending it. I am not for the attacks, but I find it interesting in a geopolitical strategy thing, in the sense of, again, if someone, you know, if you saw someone being attacked, you might jump in and stop that attack. If you saw someone getting beat up at the store and you felt like jumping in to stop that person getting beat up, you might. So according to some of the information I have seen is that, again, Russia's stated reason was to denazify and to ward off a genocide. So in effect, that makes it legitimate. Now that's my mental, rational, logical speaking. Emotionally, I'm sad about all this. It's causing, you know, much trauma and many refugees and all that. And yet again, this kind of stuff has been going on for years and years, but it hasn't been in the news big time. As the U.S. has done similar things to Yemen, and that's going on now with Saudi in Yemen, Iraq, Palestine, Syria, and with indigenous people. So, again, these are not all to justify anything, just to show the hypocrisies and that it takes reading between the lines, behind the lines, and doing some epistemology to figure out what is actually going on. Another significant thing that Pepe Escobar said is that one of the hidden agendas, or what is happening, is what he called, quote, the criminalization of dissent, which has already been going, end quote, which has already been going on in the whole cancel culture thing. And now, as a friend pointed out, it's gone, it's like gone global. There was a university in Milan that tried to ban the teaching of Dostoevsky because he was a Russian. That was rescinded due to a backlash. There was an opera singer who was not going to perform because she refused to rescind or denounce, or she didn't denounce Putin for his actions. And so where do you draw the line? I mean, let's ban, according to this logic, all, you know, basically all Apple and other cell phones and gadgets will be banned because they require cobalt, which is, uses slave child labor in the Congo to produce the cobalt, which is an essential ingredient in the gadgets. So let's ban, if we're going to ban the opera, let's ban the cell phones, let's ban the smart, you know, the iPhones, whatever they're called. I don't have one. Let's ban the opera, let's ban let's not ban literature, because that's what this show is about. get lit with literature. But that's the way the insanity is going, is to just ban everything, and what's left? I mean, what is left after you do that? NASCAR driving and Disney movies? I mean, that seems to be where it's headed, unless people get some sanity. So now I'm going to switch to some of the background information that's in an essay that I had posted in 2014 and is in my book, Drive Through Theofascism and the Hero's Journey, which in part shows how essentially fascism might go by Mussolini's definition of corporate powers and state powers combined. He also called it corporatism. And that is backed by a religious ideology, which that's a whole nother discussion, but that's basically the brunt of 2,000 years of world history and the horrors that have been perpetrated due to people assuming a God-given right to take resources and control state politics. So on with the quotes. So somewhere back in the mid-90s, I got fascinated with Nazism as a manifestations of it in the modern world, and so that has loosely been an ongoing study of mine for years, and flavors many of my books, my recent books, as one aspect of what's going on in the world. Not, by far, not all of it, but just flavors it. So I want to bring that topic up in the context of all the finger-pointing. Again, this is not to defend or support anyone in particular, but all the finger-pointing at Putin and Russia and all the solidarity being shown for Ukraine, because it's actually a mixed bag. So in my book, Drive Through, Theo-Fascism and the Hero's Journey, published in 2015, this I quoted in an essay that was first published at Axis of Logic in July of 2014. The essay is called Extremist Sports Psychology, Step Back, There's Nothing to Not See. And that's my trademark pun of N-O-T-S-E-E to make fun of and diminish things that are Nazi, because the Nazis don't see the beauty of the world. They don't see the beauty of the earth. They don't see the beauty in each being, whether human or otherwise. And as a person of German and Jewish and Russian and Ukrainian and other heritages, I have a right to make jokes about that stuff. So anyway, here's the quote, because it's significant today. I was doing a little bit of a survey. One of the essays I was doing a survey of, because sort of like a resurgence of various sects of, there's far right in the U.S. and Nazism and neo-Nazism in Europe. But and one of the quotes begins, Svoboda is a neo-Nazi party, Ukraine's fourth biggest party, holding 36 seats out of 450 in parliament. They're also part of the Alliance of European National Movements, along with the BNP, British National Party, and Jobbik, J-O-B-B-I-K. Svoboda is supported directly by Washington. This is from an article. One was from Huffington Post, which I don't think a whole lot of nowadays, and one is from Global Research, which I do think a lot of nowadays. Confirmed by Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, key organizations in the Ukraine, including the neo-Nazi party Svoboda, were generously supported by Washington. We have invested more than $5 billion to help Ukraine to achieve these and other goals. We will continue to promote Ukraine to the future it deserves. The U.S. has installed a neo-Nazi government in Ukraine. That's back in around 2014. That was in Global Research. And then from Huffington Post, also in Ukraine is the Right Sector, a coalition of rightist paramilitary groups, which was also prominent in the Maidan protests. And then I wrote, since part of the reason for Israel's formation had to do with providing a haven from post-World War II Nazism, one would think that the Jewish state would be speaking out against such atrocities. According to various reports, however, the opposite is true. And this is a quote from the Global Research article, two Global Research articles. One, Ukraine Israeli Special Forces unit under neo-Nazi command involved in Maidan, that's M-A-I-D-A-N riots. And the next article, Israeli backs fascist putscht, P-U-T-S-C-H, supports neo-Nazi anti-Semitic forces in Ukraine. Now that's a clusterfuck if you ask me. Israel supports neo-Nazi anti-Semitic forces. Neo-Nazi and anti-Semitic forces in Ukraine. Okay, here's the quotes. Neither the Tel Aviv government nor the Israeli media have expressed concern regarding the fact that the Euromaidan protests were led by neo-Nazis. Both the government and media in Israel have responded by refraining from commenting on the growth of neo-Nazi and anti-Semitic forces in Ukraine and the critical role they played in the Western-backed coup. They have downplayed or ignored entirely the fact that the U.S. and the European powers had for months The U.S. and European powers, this is me commenting now, the very powers that are totally gung-ho pro-Ukraine and anti-Russia now, had for months been financing and working with fascist organizations such as the Svoboda Party and the Right Sector to bring down the Yanukovych regime. He was the one that was in office. This is despite the fact that Svoboda leaders have made anti-Semitic public statements and the Right Sector's paramilitary forces dress in uniforms modeled on Hitler's Waffen, SS, and sport swastika-like emblems. These neo-fascist and anti-Semitic forces have launched attacks on Ukraine's Jewish community, which numbers around 200,000, mainly in Kiev, targeting synagogues. Israelis' response to the crisis in Ukraine testifies to the fact that the Israeli ruling elite speaks not for world Jewry, as it likes to claim, but for Israel's capitalist class, a corrupt and venal social layer that carries out criminal attacks on Palestinians and others in alliance with Washington. There's more. Ayelet Shaked of the ultra-nationalist Jewish Home Party called for the slaughter of Palestinian mothers who give birth to little snakes. They have to die and their houses should be demolished so that they cannot bear any more terrorists, Shaked said. So this is just, you know, this is disgusting stuff, and it angers me. But I'm bringing it up because of the context of what is going on nowadays and to show the utter hypocrisy that is going on. And again, I'm all for peace, and I'm all for people getting along. But when you have the very same people that are supporting and funding neo-Nazis 8 years later, coming out righteously, calling for sanctions that would... Hillary Clinton called for sanctions against the Russian people, saying, quote, sadly, unquote, that she didn't care if there was tremendous hardships for the people. Now, if that's not cruel, I don't know what is. So anyway, I'll recommend a couple of books to keep this. Yeah, there's my book, Drive Through Theofascism and the Hero's Journey. It's a collection of essays, poems, and photos. I don't know if these things, I guess they're not outdated, because, hey, it's very topical now. And then I'll also mention another book to put in context, Annie Jacobson's national bestseller, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. And the quote that I want to say from there, which is behind the scenes of all this nonsense, this referred to a chemist or somebody, Hoffman's anti-plant work in herbicides was one element of Detrick. That's Fort Detrick. That's where some of the suspicion of the coronavirus came from. Was one element of Detrick's three-part biological weapons division, the other two being anti-man and anti-animal. Anti-animal weapons were aimed at killing entire animal populations with the goal of starving to death the people who relied on those animals for food. So this is the underlying gist of anything extremist, anything Nazi, is that behind all the rhetoric and behind all the who's funding who and behind all that is the consciousness of anti-life, anti-plant, anti-animal, anti-man, and in that sense, anti-earth. This is a battle to protect Mother Earth, because these insane people, anybody who claiming to be Nazi or neo-Nazi or whatever the heck they are, carries a consciousness of anti-plant, anti-animal, anti-man, anti-Earth. So that's why I bring this stuff up, and why it obviously it stirs the emotions, because it's serious stuff. But when I see it get distorted in the media, it raises the importance to speak out. So again, I say do some research, find out, look at the bigger picture, and meanwhile talk to the trees and the birds and the plants. Otherwise, in your own little way, you'll be anti-plant. In your own little way, you'll become anti-whatever, and you don't want to be a neo-Nazi. And to show you how the history connects and repeats itself unless learned from, as they say, Annie Jacobson's book, Operation Paperclip, as I mentioned, the phrase anti-plant So this is just in the news at NEO, Near Eastern Outlook, which, by the way, I give a nod to the late intrepid journalist, a most compassionate human being, Andrei Vlechek, who in his writings had mentioned several websites which I now follow, Telesur and New Eastern Outlook and RT, which I can't really follow anymore. But here's the article in NEO. But the Biden's family interests in Ukraine are not limited to energy alone. In Ukraine, for example, with Biden's encouragement, large-scale production of genetically modified products, which had previously been banned in the country and in the EU, has begun. Nevertheless, Kiev started to hand over Ukrainian precious fertile soil to Western multinationals that produce genetically modified products. One of these companies was, above all, Monsanto, a multinational corporation that produces GMO seeds for cereals and vegetables. Joe Biden's son was already, in 2015, chairman of the board of the U.S. World Food Program and represented Monsanto in Ukraine. At the same time, the corporation has a controversial reputation for producing the deadly chemical Agent Orange, which was used by the U.S. military during the Vietnam War to drive Viet Cong guerrillas out of the forests, killing thousands of civilians along the way. However, it should be remembered that the cultivation of GMOs in Ukraine was included not without Biden's patronage in the country's Euro Association Agreement. So again, it's a Western Europe kind of thing going on, and decidedly anti-plant. Back in 2014, that year again, Elena Fomina, head of the Seed Association of Ukraine, said that the corporation was already present in 11 regions of the country where it grows GMO products. And to give Putin a point, here is a 2018 article. I'm not sure where it's at now, but Putin pledges to make Russia's world largest supplier of GMO-free food. And another note as of Saturday morning, two interesting articles backing up previously cited information through the Twitter sphere. This is from Telesur. NATO planned to launch a war against Russia. Azarov, who served as Ukrainian prime minister three times, NATO was planning to launch a third world war using nuclear weapons against Russia, and the main role in this was given to the current American-dominated ruling elite in Ukraine and the nationalists, Azarov wrote. Since December 2021, Russia has been receiving information, on and on it goes. So again, if that's true, then there's a major reasoning, again, mentioned before, of Putin's actions as protect self-defense and protection for Russia and people in Ukraine, which is, again, the total opposite spin of the Western European media. And the other headline in Telesur, also citing Azarov, thousands of lives saved by Putin in Donbass republics. Thousands of lives in the republics of Donetsk and Lugansk, noted Nikolai Azarov. Furthermore, the former prime minister drew attention to the conviction that NATO was also involved in developing such a plan. He pointed out that 5,000 soldiers from the U.S. had previously been deployed in Poland. They say there is no Nazism in Ukraine. Wait, there is no Nazism, do you think? Isn't it Nazism to kill journalists in the street? Isn't it Nazism to discriminate against people based on their political views and cutting off the water supply to populated areas? Isn't Nazism? So again, if this is all accurate, you have a different story. And considering the previous information given about the buildup since 2014, in which journalist, another journalist who I admire and follow, Max Blumenthal, stated that, in essence, the war has been going on since 2014, and Putin did not start the war. He started the blatant media propaganda, media-presented attacks. And yet another report mentioned the whole Chernobyl. Is there another Chernobyl? And that was reported as a hype and totally calmed down and no problem. So this is what these two narratives can do. And an additional note in the spy versus spy department. There is a possibility that, considering what's called global corporate empire, like the World Economic Forum is one aspect of that, that Russia and Putin are in on the whole thing, which is a mind-bending kind of thing to contemplate. But, you know, when you look at who benefits is the weapons industry, and who gets hurt is the common people and the earth energies. So, I don't know, but I just put that forward because in this, as I'm contrasting the good guy, I don't mean to contrast good guy versus bad guy, rather to bring to light some of the history and as a context of what's going on. Yet, Russia is known for gobbling up resources. So, in that big picture of pro-life, pro-animal, pro-plant, pro-earth, those things, in my humble opinion, are worth considering. And part of that spy versus spy thing is the there's some discussion about Putin having been trained by the World Economic, Putin alignment with the World Economic Forum, and basically Russia and China, in a way, even though it's multipolar, still part of a global corporate empire compared to the U.S. Western superpower empire. So that's how I see it, in a way, that there is, on the one hand, I think genuine fighting to squelch neo-Nazis, and on the other hand, there's the avoidance of the respect for Mother Earth, because to whatever degree, I'm not sure, but there's certainly what they call technocratic or technocracy happening with Russia and China becoming the new so-called powers. So it's a tangled web. The PS note is that while putting this together, recording and editing it, I realized personally that because of some of my DNA being German, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarus, of Jewish heritage, that I am feeling, not having grown up in the heat of it and all that, I am feeling some flavors of whatever, World War II stuff was about. And that got me to think that on a deeper level, that because I've heard other people mention this, and I even when I saw before the attacks started happening, I saw a photo of people being deported, or people leaving, I think it was Ukraine, on trains, and it reminded me of the photos of World War II when Jews and others were taken to the ovens, the concentration camps. So my deeper point here is I feel like that metaphysically and in a practical, meaning literal way, that because there is unresolved stuff around World War II that is resurfacing for humanity and consciousness so as to be dealt with. For example, after World War II, along with the mentioned Operation Paperclip, where the U.S., supposedly fearing that the Russians would get the Nazi engineers and scientists and those types, they welcomed them to the U.S. So aside from that point, there was also a point to have peace in the world. And this is something I learned from historians. That was a time, an optimal time to have peace in the world. But instead, there had to be, in this insane geopolitics, there had to be a maintaining of an enemy. So instead of the world turning towards peace, then it turned towards anti-Russia after that again, even though the Russians had lost, I think it was 20 million people in the World War II. Way more. Like, the U.S. did not win the war. That's total historical bullshit. The Russians lost so many more people, and they are never given credit for that. And that explains, in part, I would say, psychologically, why they are jittery. They have that history behind them. But anyway, I think there was an opportunity for peace now, so I see this as another cycle. This is resurfacing. This stuff is resurfacing to work through undealt with emotions and geopolitics and grief and trauma that happened around World War II and that never got resolved. It just got perpetuated in different packages, in different formats, and that's some of what I see is playing out now. So as intense and seemingly tragic as it is, on the bright side, I see it as an opportunity now for humanity to work through whatever is being worked through, to have a more peaceful swing, because that, you know, a lot of people are voicing that. Even in the amongst other insanities of the 21st century, people are on edge when it comes to war. So I think that's what's happening. I like to think that's what's happening. All right, thank you again for listening, and be well.